The streetlights come on, it's getting dark. She's supposed to be home before the streetlights come on. She wasn't home yet, so I'm thinking she's just out there playing with a friend. She never came home.
She should be playing with a friend. She should be going to school and enjoying herself. I'm not strangled, murdered, and treated like a piece of garbage.
Seeing her laying there smoldering has tore you up. It's one of those cases that never leave you. And Stanley's making sure of that.
There's no doubt whatsoever in my mind or heart that they have the right man.
He looked at and or processed 10,000 items of evidence and never found anything that connected Jennifer and Stanley.
I mean, I like cheese, but I'm not a rat. I like kids, but not like that.
You're listening to Suspect Convictions, a podcast from WVIK and Scott Reeder. I'm Lacey Scarmana, and this week we're joined by a panel of other podcast hosts and contributors to talk about what we know so far about the case against Stanley Liggins for the 1990 murder of 9-year-old Jennifer Lewis. But first, Scott Reeder is here with me in studio to answer some listener questions. Scott, Erica Hogan asks, was Stanley a scapegoat because of his drug history and he was close to the family? How thoroughly were others investigated?
Well, you know, that's a good question. The prosecutor in the case, Bill Davis, has said that others were looked at very thoroughly and that based on circumstantial evidence, it's clearly Stanley Liggins. Other folks involved say, no, they focused in on him right away and disregarded all the other potential suspects in the case.
And Katie Nichols asks, how long were Sherry, Jennifer's mother, and Joseph Glenn together before Jennifer's murder? And why was Joe in jail when Sherry went to Stanley for money?
Well, they had lived in the Quad Cities together for about 2 years, and before that they lived briefly in Des Moines, Iowa. So they've been together 2 or 3 years. They'd gotten married about a year before Jennifer was murdered. And Joe was in jail for selling lookalike drugs. It was alleged that he would telling people that it may be a LSD when it was really just construction paper with Bactine put on it.
Okay, thank you for your questions. And if there are more questions, you can ask them on the Suspect Convictions Facebook page or tweet with the hashtag #SuspectConvictions. We also have some people joining on Skype, Colin Miller, a professor at the University of South Carolina Law School and participant on the podcast Undisclosed. Amber Hunt is the host of the podcast Accused from the Cincinnati Inquirer, and she is from Bettendorf, Iowa, right here in the Quad Cities. And Payne Lindsay is producer of the podcast Up and Vanished. First, I'll have you all introduce yourselves a bit more. Payne, why don't you tell us about Up and Vanished?
Yeah, so I'm Payne Lindsay. I'm a documentary filmmaker, and I currently host and produce a podcast called Up and Vanished, which is about an 11-year-old cold case from South Georgia. A woman named Tara Grinstead went missing 11 years ago, and it's one of the top unsolved cases here in Georgia, and it's now grown to be the biggest case file in the history of Georgia. So I'm doing an investigative podcast looking into persons of interest, re-examining evidence, and trying to figure out what happened.
Okay, and Colin, can you tell us about Undisclosed and what courses you teach?
Sure, I teach evidence, criminal law, and criminal adjudication, and Undisclosed looks into cases of possible wrongful convictions. Our first season followed up in the Adnan Syed case out of Serial. We just wrapped our second season, which is about the Joy Watkins case out of Georgia, and on February 6th, we're going to start a new series of episodes about a South Carolina case that I'm working on.
And Amber, you're from the Quad Cities, so you're perhaps more familiar with some of the places we're talking about. But tell us about how you ended up producing Accused in Cincinnati.
Well, thanks. I was looking at the case as a reporter, so I had no intention actually of doing it as a podcast. It wasn't until we started really digging into it and examining the case that we thought maybe it would work as a podcast. So Accused came out in September of last year and did pretty well and well enough that we're actually going to have a season 2 looking at a new case.
That's great. That sounds similar to Scott Reeder, who we have here. He's a newspaper reporter who is going back to look at the Stanley Liggins case for a book he's working on. So Scott, I'll start with you. How has it felt returning to this case after so much time away from it?
It's been very emotional for me. Obviously being one of the first people on the crime scene that night, and I can still say at age, 51, it is the most horrible thing I've ever seen in my life. And I've been to a lot of crime scenes over the years and seen a lot of bad things, but this was the worst. It's been also been really invigorating as an investigative reporter to be going back through files and knocking on doors and interviewing people and hunting down sources that had never been talked to before and kind of developing this. That has been really exciting for me, and I found that very professionally rewarding as well.
Yeah, we've gone through police reports and trial testimony, talked to a large amount of people. What surprised you the most about how this case was handled?
Well, there's a lot of things there that were surprising. What really startled me was, I was looking through the appellate court documents, 20-some years later, and, an appellate court found that documents were withheld from the defense. 78 police reports, and, that a key witness in the case had been a paid police informant, and that was never disclosed to the defense, are things that really are troubling.
Yeah, Colin, when we were talking about setting up this panel, you mentioned that you wanted to bring up the Brady violations. Can you explain what that is and how it pertains to this case?
Sure. There's a Supreme Court case, Brady versus Maryland, and it says under the Due Process Clause, the prosecution has an affirmative obligation to turn over material exculpatory evidence. That's evidence that's favorable to the defendant, and there's a reasonable probability that that evidence could result in a different outcome, namely an exoneration. And in this case, it was just shocking to hear. I think it was 77 police reports had not been turned over, some of them quite important. And my understanding from looking at some of the materials is actually the judge appointed a special master to sift through all the discovery in this case, and that's how it was discovered that these documents were not turned over, at least to the second defense team. I guess the prosecutor has said he turned it over to the first team of defense attorneys, but not the second team.
There seems to be some dispute. I've talked to the first defense attorney who later went on to serve 20 years as a judge in the area, and he says he never received them either. The prosecutor insists that he did turn them over, so there's discrepancy between what both people say. And I might add, they both hold each other in high esteem and speak well of each other, but they have a difference of opinion on whether it was turned over or not.
Well, that seems to be one of the issues that keeps coming up with these cold cases, though. And in fact, it doesn't have to be a cold case. There's no standard way to document things, so stuff can turn up missing and all of this. I think all of these podcasts have some underlying similarities, and that's one of them, is that there's nothing standard to point to keep things in order.
Let me ask you this, Colin, because I've wondered about this. Under the Brady case law, it says it's left up to the prosecutor to determine what is exculpatory. Does that create problems? Isn't that a judgment call being made by the prosecution as opposed to the defense?
Yeah, absolutely. And some have said we should switch it and have it go to the judge to have the judge review, just as the special master did in this case. And we've reported on a few cases out of Maryland in connection with the Adnan Syed case, where there was one case in particular, someone else confessed to the crime, the defendant, I think this was the Sabian Burgess case, and in that case, the detective, who was one of the detectives in the Adnan Syed case, listened to the confession and he deemed it not to be reliable or credible and didn't turn it over. And then eventually, years later, it was investigated. It turned out this was credible. This person committed the crime. And years later, finally, Sabian Burgess was released from prison. And that's the problem when you have either the prosecutor or the police just deciding, we think this really isn't credible. We're not going to turn it over. When, of course, the defense wants to hear that and investigate it.
Is this a regular thing that happens?
Yeah, it's one of the leading causes of wrongful convictions is prosecutorial misconduct. So you have eyewitness misidentification, you have ineffective assistance of counsel, faulty forensic evidence, false confessions, and jailhouse snitches. So it's one of the big ones is prosecutorial misconduct, and the biggest type is the failure to disclose this exculpatory evidence.
Okay.
the prosecution largely based their case on circumstantial evidence. You know, there wasn't that forensics tying any one specific person to the crime. Payne, I'll ask you, as you're listening to the story, do you think that there is reasonable doubt here?
You know, I'm probably not the best person to ask. To me, it seems some of it is compelling to me. I mean, you look at the gas can in the car and you can say, you know, anybody could have had a gas can in the car, but this guy had a gas can in the car. So, you know, to me, the evidence stacks against him, and I see it being a hard battle for him to win. That's my opinion.
What do you think, Colin?
I'm going to do my typical response of I've listened to the podcast. I've looked at some of the appellate opinions there, and I can't say yet. I would really need to look through the entire file and see a transcript of the trial. At this point, I could go either way. There's certainly some evidence that points towards guilt. There's a lot of cases where you have a conviction based just on circumstantial evidence. There's some flaws you've pointed out, but I just don't know enough about the case now to definitively say whether, in fact, there was enough for a conviction here.
I mean, you don't know, Colin?
Now, Amber, you lived in the Quad Cities. Do you remember hearing about this case at all?
No. I was a military brat, so I moved around a lot and switched families and all kinds of stuff. So I ended up I was born there, and then I ended up back there from about 94 to 96, and I graduated high school, Bettendorf. So no, it was after me, and frankly, I was like going through my own stuff. It's been an interesting case to learn about. I know the landmarks, and a lot of it is familiar, but the case itself is new.
Sure. Anybody can answer this one. As you're listening to the podcast, one of the quotes in the introduction is from Stanley Liggins when he says, "I like cheese, but I'm not a rat. I like kids, but not like that." That was in response to a reporter asking him if he likes abusing little girls. What's your take on a suspect of a crime answering that way?
I'm careful not to put too much emphasis on how somebody behaves when asked something, because how would I behave if somebody asked me, did you kill somebody? Do you like to touch little boy? Like, that's a horrifying question to begin with. But as it's compelling, it's interesting to listen to. As a reporter, I sure as hell would have used that quote. It's interesting. But in terms, especially now that I know as much, you know, I still have a lot to learn, but know as much as I do about wrongful convictions and how cases are put together, I hesitate to say, well, that shows he's guilty.
Yeah, I mean, it's always tough to I think as Amber was saying, it's tough to draw conclusions about why a person would act the way they did. I think, didn't one of the family members say that hearing that, they thought it was completely out of character? So I guess if you've never been in a position of being accused of a crime, it's tough to see how you might act when that intense scrutiny is on you.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a clever line. It kind of shows some confidence in a way. And if he didn't usually talk like that, it would almost seem like he thought about that beforehand.
Sure.
Okay.
Well, if you don't mind humoring me for an anecdote, they just had that special on JonBenet Ramsey, right? And they analyzed how her brother behaved in videos from way back then, and they used his supposedly bizarre behavior to basically say, clearly, this shows this kid had a guilty conscience and he killed his sister. And I got so angry watching that, in part because you can't tell people how to behave in any given situation, whether it's grief or, I mean, he knew that little girl. I don't know how much her death, if he didn't have anything to do with it, how much her death would have affected him on an emotional level. One of my family members died of cancer. My uncle grabbed a lime and bit through it, rind and all, just to make us laugh. If that had been behavior described in a courtroom, people would have thought he was nuts. But people act in strange ways when they're going through something emotional. So it's hard to really put too much emphasis on a behavior when you don't have the evidence. That's why it's not enough to convict a person.
We also touched on race a bit, and mostly in the fifth episode. Stanley Liggins is black, Jennifer Lewis was white. Two all-white juries convicted Stanley. There was one man on the first jury who said black people evolved to have smaller brains than white people, which is obviously false and racist. The prosecutor in the case seemed to think that if one person on a jury held this kind of significant bias, that others would balance it out. Having investigated and gone back and looked through some wrongful conviction cases, how much does the jury play into that in their personal biases that you found?
You can't really know that either, because a good chunk of that depends on how forceful that personality is. If you have somebody who's really persuasive, having one person with a very strong point of view could sway the other 11 in an hour. It really just depends on what happens behind those closed doors, and we are never privy to that.
What do you think, Colin? I mean, you've obviously been a student of how juries behave and how evidence is presented. I mean, do racial biases make a big difference on juries?
You cited that study, The Impact of Jury Race in Criminal Trials, that Florida study. And actually, I was being asked in the Michael Slager trial, the trial of the shooting here by the police officer in South Carolina, and I'd come across that same study that you were citing. And as much as we might guess as to the effect it has, I think that study did a nice job of concretely showing if you have an all Caucasian jury, that they convict African-American defendants at a statistically significantly higher rate than they do for Caucasian defendants. And I think that says it all. You have the empirical data there that it does have this effect.
I guess one of the questions that comes to my mind here, Colin, is we have to go back to 1990, you know, when this crime occurred, and you know, the trial shortly after that, a couple of years actually. So it's just right after apartheid ends in South Africa, and you have a person who has immigrated from South Africa to Iowa, and he's in the jury pool. If you are the judge in this case and not one of the attorneys, would you have found it incumbent upon you to ask a few more pointed questions about what his attitude towards race is?
Was this a capital case? Was the death penalty on the table?
Iowa doesn't have the death penalty.
Oh, okay. It's interesting. There's Supreme Court precedent on this. There's a case actually out of South Carolina, Ham versus South Carolina, and then a second case, Restano versus Ross. And what they say is unless it's a capital case involving a defendant and a victim of different races, the judge does not have to either permit or engage in special jury questioning on racial bias. And there's a lot of controversy, especially in recent years, with some of these police shooting cases saying that this questioning should take place. I agree with you. I think that in a case like that, it's incumbent upon the judge to either permit or engage in that questioning himself. But too often, based upon these two Supreme Court cases, that questioning doesn't take place and you have results where you wonder the extent to which bias might have played a role.
I mean, I guess what comes through my mind is, come on. I mean, yeah, he's not facing the death penalty because the state doesn't have it, but he's facing the most stringent penalty that Iowa can melt out, which is life imprisonment. I mean, to me, that's a pretty big deal. We're not going to kill you, but we'll lock you up for the rest of your life. Shouldn't we kind of held to the same standard?
Yeah, I would completely agree with you. And essentially every aspect of how we do jury selection is flawed. The Supreme Court case on the use of peremptory challenges and whether that constitutes a biased use of those is Batson versus Kentucky. And essentially everyone says that that has no teeth. And studies show that you have the defense striking jurors of a certain race and gender and the prosecutors generally striking jurors of a certain race and gender. The entire process, I think, needs to be rethunk. And to your point, I think that there should be more questions about potential bias. Jurors won't always be honest, but you can at least catch some of those, like this South African juror who on your podcast was just out there with these opinions. And you imagine that he would have been caught up by the judge if this questioning were used.
Well, the other thing that was interesting is his wife was on the jury.
I have never seen that before, having a husband-wife pair on a jury. That was very surprising to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like the Quad Cities is a tiny little community with a tiny pool of people you could draw from for jurors. This is a metropolitan area of, you know.
I'm assuming they went and bought a lottery ticket right after because,
yeah.
I mean, the odds are so, So with him, especially though, to your question, a lot of times when a judge or during voir dire, a lawyer asks a potential juror about their personal opinions and, you know, how much they've heard about the case, you don't always know if you're getting the honest answer. He clearly thought that some of what he was saying was scientifically backed.
Yes.
So I think it wouldn't have been that difficult to suss that out, because he was saying it in such a way that he didn't seem to realize it was prejudiced.
You know, it's interesting, too, when I talked to the defense attorney in that first trial, you know, who I mentioned that went on to become a judge, and he's very respected in the community. I think from all people I've talked to say he was a very capable defense attorney. I said, why on earth did you allow this guy on the jury? And he goes, because, Scott, there were 10 Iowans on that jury that were worse. And this was, I felt like I had to take a risk there.
Well, that's nice that that's how the system works, right?
Yeah. One of the things, Amber, that I remember from your podcast is you had some personal experience with a polygraph. And, you know, of course, Stanley, according to the police, did not pass the polygraph. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your experience of being put in the chair and questioned? Tell us how that came about, and, you know, what your experience
sure.
with it is.
It actually, it's really funny. I just looked up the clip today for weird reasons. But the very first case I covered that was a murder case was in Port Huron, Michigan. I worked for a small 30,000 circulation paper called the Times Herald. And in that case, there was a 16-year-old boy working at a pizzeria. He was shot execution style, and two teenage boys confessed. And this was the first time I had covered any major murder, period. It turned out to be a doozy. I walk in and there are all these kids and they're protesting outside the jail for this hearing. And I was like, what are you guys doing? You know, you're out here. And he confessed. What's wrong with you? And they said, these kids, they were coerced. And so I had to go down this whole line of reporting. And I was like, maybe 21 years old. So as part of a whole, I wrote probably 200 stories on that case. As part of the investigation, I took a lie detector test to explain to readers how it would work. And when they're not interrogating you for something like a crime, they've got a set of safe questions that they ask. And basically, they have you like write a number from 1 through 10 on a sheet of paper, and then you put it under your leg, and they hook you all up. And then was the number you wrote number one? And you answer. And they try to figure out which number you had written based on your physiological response, because you're supposed to say no to everything and they're supposed to be able to tell when you were lying. And by God, the thing found me out, you know, it knew right away that my number was 7 or whatever. And he could show me why. But then when you learn more about the complicated types of questions and that get asked during a real polygraph, and you learn about how your body might respond when you just found, say, your best friend or your girlfriend murdered and you're being strapped to a machine an hour later, you realize, well, that physiological response might not be as predictive as it seems. So it was a really great experience for me, especially as a young reporter. It taught me a lot about how it works and why it's not typically admitted.
Did you feel like your body reacted differently when you asked the number, I guess, was it number 7?
No,
did you feel like
your body
acted differently at all?
Did it surprise you? The whole point on my side was to try and trick the machine. So right. I'm like, keep your breathing slow. You know, I felt nothing, but he was able to point to these numbers that showed a spike in my perspiration and my heart rate and all that. And I believe it because, you know, he was right. If he had chosen the wrong number, I'd assume he was full of crap. It's really interesting. I think it can be used as a tool, but you have to just really keep in mind how the person reading the results, how much their interpretation matters, and how, you know, your body can react to stress in weird ways or not if you're a psychopath. So there are a lot of things to keep in mind. It's not just as simple as guessing 1 through 10.
Well, you know, I talked to the head of the Illinois Innocence Project, and he characterizes polygraphs as complete junk science, something that isn't allowed in court. And he said there's a lot of junk science that is allowed in court, but he said this is something that isn't even make the threshold of being allowed into court. And he says, you know, they focused this investigation on Stanley Liggins after he apparently didn't pass the polygraph. Why are they doing this? I mean, this is one of the leading reasons why there's problems out there, is because they get misled. I mean, have you come across this, Colin? I mean, some of the cases you've seen, I mean, where polygraphs have misled investigators to focus on the wrong guy?
Absolutely. And polygraphs, it's a huge tool used by the police to gather leads, to corroborate their belief that certain suspects are involved, and to dispel the belief that other ones are involved. And right, the problem is sometimes they can be right and they can put you on the right path, but other times you can have either false positives or false negatives. And the problem is certain types of people are likelier to have results that aren't accurate. And that includes people who might be called sociopaths or psychopaths, who wouldn't have the type of reaction you would expect. And those are the people who might be involved in the crime. You can get a false negative. And then you have other people who are simply anxious because they're being interrogated, or as Amber noted, it might be a case where they're learning that a loved one has died and they could have a certain physiological response that's a false positive. And so, you know, it's tough to say we should outlaw the use of polygraphs, but it's certainly something where the police should not exclusively rely upon them to either rule out or rule in certain suspects.
Now, I remember, Amber, you said on your podcast, it was better than your mother. Explain that.
So my mom passed away when I was 12, but that woman could tell if I was lying from across the room. I still think that maybe she had some kind of sixth sense that goes beyond the usual mom senses stuff. But it was mostly a writing tool. I mean, my point was, she could always tell. This thing could definitely tell. And I think a few times I had tricked her. I didn't feel when I walked out of there that I would have been able to trick that machine into thinking my number was 4 or whatever. But to something you said earlier, polygraphs actually can be allowed in court in certain situations with both sides agreeing. So it's a little tricky to just say it's total junk. It's just not reliable enough for anybody to put blinders on because of it. I think it could be a tool. I wish that investigators would keep in mind the limitations of it before they decide to focus entirely on somebody based on a polygraph. That's, I think, a mistake.
One of the key witnesses in the case was the cellmate of Stanley Liggins in the county jail while he was awaiting trial. And he said that he had admitted to committing the crime to him and testified to that. And this guy is a career criminal. And I drove out to Sioux City, Iowa to interview him. And I finally found him. And his brother hands me the phone. And he calls him up. And I'm chatting. And he goes, I don't want to talk to you. And I said, well, I drove all the way out here. I don't care. I don't want to talk to any reporters. And we're going back and forth. And I finally say to him, hey, guy, you know, I've driven 9 hours out here. My wife is just going to kill me if I don't come back with an interview with you. Can you give me a break? You know, you've been married before. You know how this is. And he goes, okay, fine. Come on down to the construction site where I'm working, and you can interview me there, you know. So, you know, I drive on down to this construction site and I interview him. And, you know, one of the things he testified to is, you know, he hadn't been offered anything in exchange for his testimony. But then he says to me, well, the police told me that if I didn't testify against Stanley Liggins, they were going to charge me with accessory to murder after the fact, which, from what I've gathered from defense attorneys, is total nonsense. And then I questioned him a little more, and I said, well, I noticed that instead of sending you to Fort Madison, which is like Shawshank Redemption-type prison times 10, I mean, it's a really horrible place, they sent you to Rockwell City, which is a nice, modern prison. He indicated that it may have been a reward for cooperating with the prosecution.
But now we should say the former prosecutor, Bill Davis, says this was news to him, that he personally interviewed Frank a number of times and he never made him any promises in exchange for his testimony.
But I thought it was curious that this came up. And I know, Colin, that you've come across this issue a lot of cellmates testifying against each other. What compels these people to do this? And does it result in very many wrongful convictions?
Oh, absolutely. Jailhouse informant testimony is one of the leading causes of wrongful convictions. And in our second season case, the Joy Watkins case, there was just this whole line of jailhouse informants, and some recanted, some changed their story, some had statements that didn't match the physical evidence in the case at all. But absolutely, I mean, the motivation here is you have a person in prison and they might be in there for a decade, 20 years, they might not like their current environment, and they're seeing in this case an opportunity for leniency, getting out earlier, preferential treatment from the guards, a change in prison. And that's the problem, is they have these motivations. The officers want the conviction. And, you know, the case that's most susceptible to a wrongful conviction based upon jailhouse informant testimony is the very case where the state has a weak case against the defendant, and therefore they're reaching out, and whether through reward money or promises of leniency, they're getting these people to implicate the defendant.
So I guess what runs through my mind is, I mean, I spent most of my career as a legislative reporter, and of course, Illinois was kind of the forefront of the issue of capital cases and wrongful convictions and all of that. And one of the issues that came up was jailhouse informants. I mean, have any states cracked down on the issue or restrict when jailhouse informants can be used?
Yeah, well, to your point, Illinois is one of the leading states. They require a reliability hearing, and they have heightened discovery requirements when the prosecution wants to have informants testify. California is another big one. They don't allow jailhouse informant testimony unless there's some external corroboration. So there are a few other states, but those are the two leading ones where they've really decided that this is a leading cause of wrongful convictions, and they are trying to make sure that that evidentiary hurdle is heightened so that you only get the reliable testimony and the evidence.
Okay, here's another thing. You have this woman who testified against Liggins, who said that she saw these taillights from a distance and she'd recognize those taillights anywhere. Well, we find out later that this person had been a paid police informant before the trial came about. And this was never apparently disclosed to the defense or, of course, to the jurors as well. Do you come across that very often, where you deal with paid police informants who are providing testimony in cases like this?
Yes, but it's usually disclosed. So that's what's unique about this case. There are plenty of cases where you do have paid informants and they're testifying, and there's something known as the informant instruction, and that instructs the jurors that they're to take the testimony with a grain of salt because this is a person who is literally being paid by the state like an expert witness. So in the Liggins case, the problem here is, and part of the reason his conviction was thrown out, is it wasn't disclosed, and the jury had every right to hear that. And that instruction very much tells jurors that they should have some skepticism for this testimony.
Okay. Payne, I want to go back to you. I think you came from a film background. Is that correct, when you started up your podcast?
Yeah, I did.
And I think I was reading on your website a few days ago that you call yourself an amateur investigator. I want to know what you learned from this process and how you get to find your sources and connecting evidence.
I mean, to me, the basic premise of the whole idea is, when you're amateur sleuthing, or if you're a real detective, you got to be good with people, good enough to talk to them, to gain their trust, and to move on to the next person, be able to read people. So I guess my background in documentary filmmaking kind of helped me a little bit as far as being able to talk to certain people. And maybe it was a refreshing approach for some people. Instead of a man in a badge, it's a 29-year-old kid, and they're like, who is this guy? So I tried to use that to my advantage a little bit. But what I've learned is really just how to gain that trust, keep it, and, you know, make it real. I mean, because the thing is, not everybody is guilty. And in Tara's case, in my podcast Up and Vanished, there's a lot of different persons of interest. There's tons of names. And it's one of those cases where I could sit here and present probably five different people and make each one of those people sound guilty. Now, I don't want to do that, but the circumstances and different pieces of evidence, you know, make that happen in this case. So I think the biggest thing that I've learned is gaining that trust and respecting people. And I think that what's different about this now being 11 years later is that because there's a spotlight on the case and the whole town of Osceola knows about the podcast, it kind of puts a little bit of pressure on certain people to come forward. And once they see others come forward and they realize that, hey, it's okay, nothing bad's going to happen, it encourages, you know, everyone else to come forward too. And, you know, in a nutshell, I've just learned how to be better when talking to people, because, you know, if you can't find any physical evidence, the evidence you're looking for is in somebody's head. So,
well, I'm going to ask this question here because Payne has touched on it. I mean, have you found with Undisclosed or with the other podcasts you do, that you're accused or Up and Vanished, do you find that the podcast or the attention that it brings affects how those involved in the process are responding? I mean, are the judges, are the prosecutors, are the defense attorneys handling things in a different way than they might otherwise?
With accused in our situation, sadly, I would say the answer is no. If anything, I think we piss them off. They being the current investigators. Now, we already, our case involved 23-year-old Elizabeth Andes. She was murdered in 1978, and her boyfriend was zeroed in on very early as a suspect. He was interrogated for 15 hours. He finally confessed, and it ended up, though, that two separate juries, one civil and one criminal, found him not liable and acquitted him. So in our situation, the powers that be who investigated the case back in 78 are dead set that he's the right guy, and they do not like that we have questioned otherwise. The investigators who have followed up are much more open to it. But somewhere during the process, even though like I really worked to try and be open and not have anybody be surprised, they just got pissed off. And I think it was because we were, you know, we were questioning people who were still in power there, like the prosecuting attorney who helped charge the original suspect he's the head attorney in the county right now. So there's even a scene in the podcast where I'm like chasing him down a hallway and he will not talk to me. So for us, I think they just kind of clamped down. And I mean, there's a problem with some of these cases anyway, where cops don't want to admit when they're wrong. And when somebody who's coming from a non-law enforcement background is reaching sources and doing interviews that they themselves couldn't track down, I think it's an ego blow. I know that we did a lot of good because I know that the case is being looked at, whereas it was dormant before, but I don't think that they are suddenly like inspired to try and solve it. If anything, I think they just are digging in their heels trying to prove that we didn't do as much good as we would have liked.
So it's had an impact.
It's had an impact. It's just frustrating because I'm probably just cranky today, but part of it is last March, I walked into a police department with a bunch of evidence that we had uncovered. And I, as a journalist, don't do that. I'm not an extension of law enforcement. I don't hand over my notes. But because this involves a murder, and because the whole point of investigating it was to try and solve it, I crossed a couple lines that, you know, my bosses were fine with. Ethically, I'm cool. But I did some things that I normally wouldn't do. So I hand this over, and I know for a fact that one of the people who's still alive, who should have been interrogated back in 78, still to this day hasn't been talked to by anyone but me. That doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, I handed over the information. So as much as I would like to think that, I think these podcasts are doing a good job in educating the public, I don't know how much they're going to do in terms of changing people's minds within departments, because they are so dead set that their way is the right way. So I hope I'm wrong. Maybe I'm just being cynical today.
Let me ask you this, Colin. If it wasn't for Serial or Undisclosed, would Adnan be in a situation he is today with a possible, with a new trial coming up?
No, I mean, that's sort of the famous story with Justin Brown, Adnan's attorney, right around the time that Rabia Chowdhury, my co-podcaster, was going to Sarah Koenig and asked her to do this story. He was saying, you're at the end of the line. You've exhausted your appeals. Asia McLean didn't show up for the PCR. We're likely going to lose that, and we're not going to win on appeal. And then, quite famously, Sarah Koenig started Serial, reached out to Asia McLean, realized what had happened with Kevin Urich, the prosecutor, possibly dissuading her from testifying. And that's what led to the PCR being reopened and eventually him being granted a new trial.
About a month before Jennifer died, Stanley Liggins was arrested, a 9-year-old girl who spilled Kool-Aid on herself. She was in a swimsuit. And she went to get it wiped off, and Stanley used a washcloth, allegedly, to wash it off. And she contends that he touched her inappropriately under her bathing suit bottoms. So he was out on bond on this case when the Jennifer was died. So quite naturally, I think the police focused in on him right away. I guess the question is, does that seem like a big leap to you from a case of fondling to murder and kidnapping and sexual abuse? I mean, I don't know. What's your reaction to it?
You could look at that two ways. I mean, I'm the kind of person, in general, if you look like a duck and you quack like a duck, you're probably a duck. And it, to me, the evidence in this case really does stack against Stanley to make him look guilty. You know, obviously, the court of law will decide that coming up.
It's tough to say. I mean, because I don't know the whole evidentiary record, so I can't really say in terms of evidence of his guilt overall. There is a reasonably high recidivism rate for people engaging in sexual acts with children. As you say, the Kool-Aid incident versus this is different degrees of magnitude, but we have no idea whether that Kool-Aid incident is a one-off or isolated or the most extreme behavior he had engaged in before. So, I mean, it's really tough for me to say. I always like to be limited in my opinions unless I really know the ins and outs of the case. And I just don't know enough yet about Stanley Liggins overall, his character, his history, and the evidence in the case to say anything definitive.
Okay.
And there's something, too. I mean, if you look at the, you guys know the podcast In the Dark, right? The Jacob Wetterly case. The gentleman who ultimately confessed, and it appears to be an accurate confession, in that child murder case, his other crimes were assault. So I can't really blame police for looking at an assault and then saying, okay, is it possible that he took this one an extra step? They have to look at it that way. So I can't blame them for looking at it. Whether or not it's enough, I don't feel like I know enough about the ins and outs of it in the way that you guys do, but people do jump from sexual assault to murder. It happens all the time.
It kind of begs the bigger question, is it what's more important, getting the right person behind bars or doing it ethically and properly in the court of law? I think that obviously, Colin, you probably have a stronger opinion about that, but that's kind of the general question that always is asked when, you know, wrongful convictions and these sorts of things is, you know, is it about getting the right person behind bars or is it okay to let them slip because you didn't do it right?
Yeah, I think that's a big thing we've seen in this case. And one of the defense attorneys has said that, you know, he saw the police officers as avenging angels trying to do whatever it takes to make this arrest happen, whether it was all done properly or not, to get this person off the streets. And I want to be clear that we aren't advocating either way. We're going through the facts and what we have available because this will be decided in a few months, which I think is an advantage that some of these shows and cases don't have, that we will have some kind of conclusion here coming up in a few months when a judge or jury looks at this again.
I'm wishing you guys well. I'll be curious to hear how it all unfolds and how much the, you know, reporting, how much opens up once the trial is over, because, you know, I'm sure that there are people who won't talk right now because the trial is pending. So that'll be interesting.
Yeah, I've been enjoying the podcast a lot, and I'm looking forward to the conclusion.
Thank you to our guests, Amber Hunt of Accused, Payne Lindsay of Up and Vanished, and Colin Miller of Undisclosed. Next time on Suspect Convictions, we'll talk about how the media covered the murder of Jennifer Lewis and the trials of Stanley Liggins.
You know, think of the consequences of these images and how they affect not only the family, but just the news viewer or the paper reader or the social media person.
That's next time on Suspect Convictions. Production support comes from Alfredo Monteca. A big thanks to Colin Thompson and Cast Media for our online presence. You can go to suspectconvictions.com for more information. And thank you to WVIK CEO Jay Pierce and the WVIK staff. All archived audio was generously provided by WQAD-TV Channel 8.